Untitled, produced and hosted by Malika Lee Whitney, will be heard on Fridays from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. Untitled presents features on the arts, culture, education, and social issues. You will also enjoy music from a variety of genres. Special guests complement the program with insightful and engaging conversation. That's Untitled, Fridays from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m. over listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
And ready or not, here it comes right now.
Taking a deep breath. Be glad we have breath. I'm Malika Lee Whitney, your producer and host of the previously described program, Untitled. Invited guests this evening include Reverend Dr. Khadija Mateen, historian, educator, clergy. And our focus will be on In the Spirit. Where are we emotionally and psychologically, given the impact of changing times? I also invited Solio, creative influencer, curator, and innovator, radio host, journalist, news DJ, along with Anthony Olubumi Akinbola, an interdisciplinary Nigerian-American artist. And we'll be talking about a very, very exciting exhibition that I can't wait to discuss and share with you all. I'll also offer highlights from Urban World 2020. This year, its 24th annual will be virtual. And I'll also offer the trailer, All In, The Fight for Democracy, directed by Lisa Cortez and Liz Garbus, How the Right Went Wrong. And it's all about voter suppression and corruption. And then we close out with commentary from Gia Watson. So stay tuned. The music you're hearing is our theme song. You should know it by now, Rivers on Mars. Good evening. Hello.
Hello.
Dr. Khadija Mateen?
Yes, this is she. How are you?
I've said a few things about you, and it deserves repeating. Historian, educator, member of the clergy. And we're going to talk about what's happening in our hearts and minds emotionally and psychologically. We know the things that are going on that are impacting us right now. Of course, perhaps first and foremost, the COVID-19 pandemic, unemployment, education, homelessness, and furloughs, and I call the backwards to school because that's not all together right now, but you're the specialist. Help us. I think I said that when I called you initially, and because I've entitled this segment In the Spirit, where can we go for an uplift, and where and how can we find it?
You know, it's good that you asked the question, and you know, a few people have asked that recently, and the first thing that came to mind was that where we need to go was deep inside ourselves, really having a solid sense of how you define yourself. And it's kind of like what we did in the 60s and 70s when we needed to effect significant change. There was clarity of purpose. There was a returning to understanding what your spirituality or your faith or religion or political premise or historical roots were, and really going back and reaffirming that, that because there are so many changes going on so many different levels of every aspect of each community, that if you're hooked into all the changes, you're not anchored anywhere. And so someone asked me today, I was walking down the street, and they said, you got a little pep to your walk. And I said, because I'm real clear about my spirit. But it doesn't mean you don't feel the impact of things. But if you're working in community, if you've reestablished roots or ties with people that hold your elbows, as my mother used to say, that don't tell you what you have to do, but help you figure out a good, righteous way to get there. It's going to take every day, and it's going to take a very purposeful effort.
What do you say to folks who have usually mentioned being hopeful, but are no more, you know, because of the disappointments, the things that they may feel are totally outside of their control?
If it's totally outside of your control, then that's the one that you don't totally focus on. And I'm not doing pie in the sky or idealistic. If I can't change something has happened to me, I can't do anything about the COVID, for instance, the pandemic, but I can change how I react while I was, instead of saying I'm in isolation, say that I'm woodshedding, I'm getting grounded. Instead of saying, oh, I can't go here, say, where do I choose to be, or how can I choose to be better? You know, so for those days that I know I couldn't go anywhere, so I reread some of the books I hadn't read in ages. I wrote letters, handwritten letters to people, not just the email. I did things that I hadn't done in a long time because it wasn't cool before. So hanging the hope shouldn't be on all the external, but rather, who are you? And that's how deep can you go to reaffirm? You determine your hope, not the person next door.
When you are sharing, for example, being a dean with the One Spirit Interfaith Seminary, I'll repeat that slowly, One Spirit Interfaith Seminary, you're preparing those who've heard a calling and are responding to it. And this is a different time where I mentioned to someone the other day that it may feel like the sandwich board that you would read that reflects the end is near. Like, what do you impart in terms of wisdom and insights to those who are pledging, you know, to do things to perhaps first clear themselves, but also offer solace and comfort to others?
One of the things that I try to help, whether they're in spiritual counseling or going for clergy, is reaffirming what their core beliefs or essence are, rereading those sacred texts and readings, that if some that they thought they were leaving or rejecting, but really looking at it from a social justice premise. What actions and teachings talk about liberation and righteousness, that talk about fairness and equity, and then how can you then incorporate that, as opposed to reading something that's going to constrict or deny the other person's humanity. So when someone says, well, this is what I believe, I always ask them, well, show me how that takes place. How does it affect what you do every day? Because that is what's going to make crucial differences in what we can affect in our community. There's so many forces that would rather that we not be. But we are. The resiliency that we have in us is the spirit for those that passed before. And they're sitting there going, y'all better get it. Y'all better get it. You know. So in preparing
another point that I wanted to raise, there's a center in all paths of spirituality. There's some place where there can be a connection. And there might be one who feels that they have not been served, you know, perhaps on the path that they've been on.
Right.
Or they may feel conflicted in either not understanding or not accepting the way that others find their path. And, you know, I'm looking to you for a lot of explaining, you know, because you're right in the midst of it. And folks say things like, pray, been doing that a long time, and nothing's changed.
You know, someone will say, nothing has changed. It's the same old. Things have changed. What also needs to change is, what is our expectation in prayer? You know, in Islam, we're taught to tether our camel and then go pray, so that after the prayer, you can go back to work. In other words, the praying, is not going to give you the solution. It's when you have been rejuvenated and your spirit is renewed or reinforced, or you have clarity of mind, then what are you going to do with that renewed energy? How then do you greet your neighbor with that renewed awareness? It is not the praying in and of itself. What are you doing? And how are you doing it? So that's the questions I ask people. It's wonderful that you received the call to serve. How do you define that serving? And do you do it to serve and journey with? Or do you think that you're going to solve everyone's problems? Because therein lies the problem right there.
True that. And how about a couple of 1, 2, 3 steps that one can begin with, just like you said, that inner self to explore?
That inner, right.
And what other points might you offer as we begin to wrap up?
Your inner self, accept yourself where you are right this minute. Your age or your shape or whatever else is going on, accept that you're alive, and give thanks. And then figure out then how can you refresh that or renew that. And as opposed to looking at I don't have, really identifying what you do have. And how does that correlate with our roots historically, socially, and politically?
And I must ask, for the one who is a giver, how do we treat ourselves? You know, because as I'm asking so much of you, and I'm hoping that our listeners here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM, you know, have all these inquiries, you know, because the way that you map things, you know, is really a clear path, you know, but it works for you and it comes from experience. And some of our thoughts and feelings have to grow up a little bit to get there, even if we think we're grown. Would you agree?
Yes, and I know I'm not grown. I know I'm trying real hard. I'm trying to listen to that inner voice. And even if I hear something that I don't quite understand, then do the research and do the study. And while you're praying, think about, now what will I do righteously?
The one and only Reverend Dr. Khadija Mateen, as mentioned, a historian, educator, and clergy. And there's a lot of other things you do, and I have to be transparent. It's the one I call on for all these very special varieties of projects that have to do with youth and elders and everybody in between. I want to thank you so much, and I wish you peace and happiness and joy in those moments that you find. Because as you are asked to support, we know that support is needed for the givers as well. And know that we appreciate you so much, and I thank you for your very clear insights. And I'll be practicing a lot of what you said this evening. Thanks again, and have a good night.
Good night, and thank you. Bye-bye.
I'm Malika Lee Whitney, and the program is Untitled, and we're here at WBAI New York, 99.5 FM on the dial. And it shouldn't surprise you that we are seeking support, your listener support, because that's what keeps this station on. You know, there are bills to be paid. We always have to make sure that We are improving the ways that we connect with our listeners, and that can only be done when we have the resources to update, take care of any obligations that are open. And in order to support not only this program, but the station on the whole, you can give. You can give to the number 2 at WBAI.org. That's one way. You can call 516-620-3602. That's another. And I do believe that the masks, which have the logo of WBAI emblazoned upon them, are still available. And I hope the bicolor ones are still available. You can also become a WBAI buddy, and that enables you to commit to a certain amount, any amount from $10 up, $10, $25, $50, whatever your resources will allow to be extracted from your account on a monthly basis. And or you can make a single donation. But again, to find out more, you can go to our WBAI.org website and choose whichever way suits you. And again, just know that your support is much appreciated, and I'm thanking you in advance because I know you're going to do the right thing. I do believe we're going to hear a little theme music from Kevin Nathaniel's Imbira Sanctuary. You know that's the go-to music for our program. Inspiration is the track, and coming up, we're going to hear from Solio and also Anthony Olubunmi Akinbola, and we're going to talk about the exhibit that I only hinted at, and I'll tell you more. But I'll start with this. Styling Black Expression, Rebellion, and Joy Through Fashion, curated by Solio, presented by Long Gallery Harlem and Nordstrom. Nordstrom, located at 225 West 57th Street in New York City. It's a satirical escapade, and it's through multifaceted representations of contemporary black style and their cultural significance. Participating artists include, as I mentioned, Anthony Olubunmi Akinbola, Ilan Cadiz, Willie Cole, Epperson, Felicia Megan, Gordon, Gregory Gray, Hollis King, Bo McCall, Ruben Natal San Miguel, Museo Olopona, Yelaine Rodriguez, Diane Smith, Stephen Teo, Ricky the Jones of Afro Lip Gloss Originals, and Margaret Vendrise. And I have to thank John Bailey, the New York City Public Relations Magnate at Nordstrom. He's been with them for over 30 years. Acknowledgements to Rose Barney, Joe Palomani, and the New York Visual Team. So, Solio?
Hello.
Hi.
How
Anthony?
Hey.
Do I have you both on the line?
Yes.
Great. So, Solio, let me begin with you. I gave a quick blurb, you know, from some of the publicity materials, but I'll ask you first and foremost to just lay out how this visionary creative project came into being.
Yeah, so it came into being, Long Gallery Harlem, Louis Long was the founder of the gallery. He was contacted by Rosa at Nordstrom and wanting to do an exhibition. And so from there, he called me into it to curate it. And when we were discussing ideas, you know, we were centered around this being the centennial of the Harlem Renaissance and this being a retail store. I was thinking, okay, how can we merge the two? And one of the things that jumped out was that the Harlem Renaissance is really about defining a new black cultural aesthetic. And one of the ways they did that, in addition to literature and performing and visual arts, was through fashion. How they presented themselves was a way to challenge the dominant narrative of who we are in America. And I wanted to use that as a departure point to reflect upon what defines contemporary black style today. And, you know, we have such an amazing list of artists, as you mentioned them, and Anthony was someone that I felt was crucial to that, specifically because of his amazing use of the durag.
As a foray in developing and creating and curating this at a major department store, I wouldn't say it hasn't been done, but it might be thought of as not a likely venue for something of this magnitude, and especially in light of the fact that it's so focused on a particular aspect of our culture. Was it an easy path to pitch?
You know, it came together very quickly. So the team at Nordstrom was very receptive and very open to any idea that we had. And so they gave us a lot of freedom and leeway. With that said, we did have a very narrow window of time. So we had about 6 weeks to put the entire show together. In addition to having the exhibition in the flagship, they were very generous in giving us a pop-up shop that also had to be curated and managed, as well as displays in the window of several of the wearable artists. So it was definitely one of the most challenging and exhausting and thrilling and ultimately rewarding curatorial experiences. I'm just honored at the fact that we have the opportunity. So it was like, go, go, go.
Well, work comes with that, work. So, Anthony, allow me to bring you in. I did happen to see a few of the visuals from your exhibition. Would you describe what it entails?
So in the front of the store, I have 2 8-by-8-foot panels, one red and one purple, that I had been working on. And on the trusses by the escalators, I have a new work that I've made for the first time that's kind of frameless, that is like a large tapestry or like quilt of durag that hangs freely within the store. And for me, it was really interesting to attempt to subvert power and redistribute it by bringing materials like that into a high-end boutique department store.
I have to say that I was intrigued, you know, because it's like, you know, the durag comes downtown, you know. I hope I'm not slighting it by that description, but also it has cultural intent and it means something, you know. It has everything to do with keeping waves in place, you know, its signature. But are there some other ways that you can describe the wearing of it as being important to the cultures who don it?
Well, the history of durag, you know, comes from an attempt to flatten or press black hair down and ultimately maintain it, but assimilate into straightening the black hair into, like, Western beauty standards. So a lot of that, or the durag, was used post-slavery too. Have a more respectable hairstyle, and it's kind of transitioned from that, and it's been redefined to almost like reinforce this blackness or this black identity. So I feel like, you know, there is the primary utility of it straightening and holding down the hair, but there's also this attempt of reinforcing blackness or resistance in wearing, you know, something like a durag to a red carpet event, or wearing it with a suit, or in spaces that are not the home, you know?
Right. And so, Leo, in the title, Styling Black Expression, is the word rebellion. And I did see that attached to it. So even the title in and of itself, can you expound on why those words collectively reflect the totality of what so much of the variety of the work is about?
I just have to say, I love the way that you phrase your questions. I just love it. we wanted to really put this into three different categories. So the expression is really sort of just the general broad way in which our style, since, you know, the continent, the motherland in Africa, all the way back to then, how we've used style to express a variety of feelings and thoughts in ourselves. And then rebellion was so important because we're in an age of Black Lives Matter movement. There's so much civil unrest and uprisings and protests. And we definitely wanted the exhibition to speak to the times that we are in today. And then the joy aspect, you know, looking back to history throughout all of the movements and the oppressive instances we've been through, we've always been able to find joy and dignity through style. through how we present ourselves. And I definitely wanted to have the exhibition at the end of the day give people that joy and that inspiration, because it is a really difficult time today. And so you have several artists in the exhibition who really encapsulate those themes.
I wanted to ask about the merch. You know, you can describe some of what's available. An associate of mine saw the recent clip on one of the cable channels and said, oh, we got to go right away. I need all those shirts. What's represented by the wearable, really cultural wearable art that's available?
Yes. So we have a really cool wearable artist in the show. We have Epperson, we have Bo McCall, and we have Busayo Alupona, as well as Ricky the Jones. He creates the Afro wigs, which are also wearable or can be displayed as they are. And also Gregory Gray, he creates paper hats. So we just really wanted to show a wide range of things. So there's scarves, there's the triple T-shirts, which can be worn six different ways. You have Epperson's amazing designs, like the Morph, another garment that can be worn several different ways. And Busayo's tie and dye, Adiri, is a print fabric. And so she harkens back to the traditional Yoruba print fabric with that work. And it's just really beautiful dresses and blazers. So there's really something for everyone in the merch, as well as the art being for sale and through partnership with Artsy. So, you know, even if you don't want the pop-up shop merch, you can buy the do-rag, paintings and the tapestry and so many other amazing pieces in the show.
And I want to ask Anthony, we all have deeply rooted ties to the continent, at least I claim it. And I'm curious in terms of what your cultural identity connects to in creating the work that you do, and how do you bring that into the fore? Because I'm sure it's beyond, you know, what we'll see at Nordstrom, but I'm sure in other ways that you share your creativity.
I mean, I'm first generation American. Both of my parents are Nigerian. And for me, there's a divide between Black America and Africa. And it's my attempt in using this material to speak on the nuances of what a first-generation experience looks like, and hopefully I can mitigate the separation between Black America and Africa through utilizing and implementing materials such as the do-rag or brushes and things of that sort.
Well, I have to say, Solio, you know, this is just such a win-win for us to be able to have so many creative expressions available to us. So we want to let our listeners know as we close the hours that folks can see it. I understand that it is free, and I should mention that part proceeds are going to Howard University for some of the sales. That's correct, I'm told.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
John Bailey mentioned that to me, and I believe you did as well. So we know that Nordstrom is located at 225 West 57th Street in Manhattan, and admission is free, but are there particular hours to be able to go through and see all this wonderful art making?
Yeah, so any hours that the store is open, so the store is open Monday through Saturday from 11 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. and Sunday from 12 to 6 p.m., so you can just take the A train from Harlem or wherever you're coming from and head inside and experience the beautiful works. And, you know, just really quickly, like, to Anthony's credit, like, the tapestry, he had literally, like, maybe 4 weeks to do a two to three story tall tapestry. So it's really a centerpiece in the show and really beautiful along with all the other works. So please check them out.
Certainly will. And I do believe I've given credit to most of the folks who had a hand in this, and I'm looking forward to see it. And it's on my agenda for this weekend, so I'll be able to talk about it some more, because the exhibitions are going to be up almost through to the end of October, correct?
Yes, October 29th is the closing.
Sounds good. Well, we've been talking about styling, Black expression, rebellion, and joy through fashion, curated by Solio and presented by the Long Gallery of Harlem and Nordstrom. I want to thank you both so much and look forward to seeing you. Have a good evening.
Thank you. You too.
I'm Malika Lee Whitney. You're tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM on your dial. And this is listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI, you know, where we get to have these very interesting conversations with very interesting folks. And coming up, I will be talking about highlights from the started Urban World Film Festival. And I'm just going to read some things about it, and then we're going to go to a clip of one of the films that's being screened, and I'm just scrolling up. Here we go. The Urban World Film Festival is an event that I look forward to each year. Its growth reveals an attentive focus on visual works, conversations, panel discussions that reflect and reveal notable creativity. The exclusive previews of major releases, as well as independent and up-and-coming producers, directors, cinematographers, and talent, definitely they have their finger on the pulse. The films tap into a variety of topical issues, from love stories, social justice, coming-of-age works, and more. The narratives, documentaries, features, and shorts are a windfall for any observer. This year, the Urban World Film Festival adapts to change due to COVID-19 and goes virtual. It's amazing how it all comes together in this format. One can be assured that the reach now will far extend and resonate even more nationally and globally. We will miss the throngs of all who have become accustomed to the live experiences of being in direct contact with makers and all that phenomenal networking. However, it's good that Urban World is on, and you can check it out at urbanworld.org, and register. And guess what? You can applaud from your very own living room. It's a full slate, and I confess, like, I'm really into the short. So, Max, if we're ready, we'll go to that clip, and I'll tell you a little bit more about some of the films that are being offered and some of the marquee folks who will be up on that screen that you look at in your living room. I'm Malika Lee Whitney. Stay tuned.
If the power of the right to vote was truly made available to everyone in America, it would change the future of this nation.
Ladies and gentlemen, Stacey Abrams!
When I started running for governor, we anticipated that voter suppression was going to be instrumental in Brian Kemp's campaign, and we were right.
We've been in line for 5 hours.
They said, you've already voted. Looks like several days ago. No, I would have remembered that.
Thousands of people were told no and didn't have the authority to demand better.
The lines are insane. We have precinct consolidation, non-training of local election officials.
I knew something had gone horribly wrong. The system that is supposed to protect our democracy didn't work the way it was supposed to.
States implement voter suppression laws all across the country.
Things like new voter ID laws, purging. You're knocked off the roll.
Gerrymandering. Changing the voting boundaries.
Ohio is a use it or lose it state.
In the United States, the right to vote is the only right you can lose simply for not using it.
Jim Crow 2.0. That's what we're saying.
We've got a lot of work to do.
When we started as a country,
6% of people were eligible to vote. There are still forces that are determined to keep citizens from voting.
Unless we fight for the right to vote, our democracy is put at risk.
The fight over voting rights is ultimately about power.
The states have figured out how to stop African Americans, Hispanics, Asian Americans, the young, and the poor from voting.
History is never a straight line. It's always a fight.
I will not concede because the erosion of our democracy is not right.
history. All this power. The vote matters. All this
power. You belong. You have value.
You were listening to All In, the Fight for Democracy, directed by Lisa Cortez and Liz Garbus. It's one of the films that's being screened at the Urban World Film Festival, this year being the 24th edition. And the subtitle of the film is How the Right Went Wrong. And it's all about voter suppression and corruption. It's a scenario that's Stacey Abrams knows all too well and has experienced. It's an Amazon release. And with what we're hearing in the news right now, we certainly know that pulling that lever in the way that has most meaning for you is what we have to do. And the news and the noise is not good. It's hard for me to process some of the things that I'm seeing and hearing. I've always been a news hound, switching around from channel to channel, checking out, you know, what's being said, and it really gives rise to making one feel slightly depressed or down. But we can't. We have to hold our heads up and make sure that we prepare ourselves for the battle that lies before us. Once again, All In, the Fight for Democracy, directed by Lisa Cortez and Liz Garbus. And although there's just a few days remaining for the Urban World Film Festival, here are some of the things that piqued my curiosity. A film entitled A Blossom in the Night, Teo Amos, and it's about class and citizenship that determines young lives. An underground movement promises change, but with circumstances. There's a film entitled Her by Wagner Cinelli. It's an animated short, and the subject matter is domestic violence, and that film is from Brazil. What's very interesting is that the selections and the curating of these films has really gone very wide globally. American Dream by Nicholas Polizine and Sylvain Loubet, and that film is from France, having to do with migration. Alice Street, directed by Spencer Wilkinson, gentrification, Spencer Wilkinson director. A Rose Between Thorns, Juliana Scamacci, that theme, a film from St. Kitts dealing with child abuse. Coming of Age Story, Charm City, director Angel Manuel Soto, and executive produced by Jada Smith and Will Smith, and features Meek Mill, a young aspiring dirt bike rider, revs up and difficult circumstances arise. And there's so many more. Keon, directed by E.G. Bailey, aspiring photographer, college student on a mission, and the cloud of police encounters hangs. Limelight, and several films with similar themes having to do with same-sex relationships. Migrante by Esteban Ezequiel Dallinger and Cesar Daniel Lezzi. And that's an animated film and from Argentina. They're films from the United States, the Congo, United Kingdom, the Caribbean, I mentioned St. Kitts, South Africa, France, Brazil, Japan, Ghana, Chile, Dominican Republic. Got Bad Hair. Malpasso, directed by Hector Valdez. And that's a narrative feature. Dark City Beneath the Beat, about Baltimore, its rhythm and movement. Director Tedra Wilson. And that's a documentary feature. There's animation, just so much. Music videos, black and white showcase, spotlight conversations, young creative showcases. Jojo Abbott has a video in there entitled Never I'm Touch. also Tender by director Felicia Pride, playing with Beethoven. A young pianist is distracted from focus and risks the opportunity that lie ahead, and that's a narrative feature. So there's so much more, and I really encourage you to go to the website, because even beyond this festival, some of these films make appearances on other slates and other places around the country and the world, so look out for them. And I'm going to ask you, Max, if you can pull up another one of Kevin Nathaniel's tracks while I take a breather. There are some other informational announcements that I want to make, and I just have to flip some pages. This is live radio, and then we can start to get ready for our next guest, a commentator that I look forward to conversing with on the regular, and her name is Gia Watson. Listen to Kevin Nathaniel. Thank you. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Looking for just some notes. Of course, the notorious RBG was not visited by Moscow Mitch, but that's okay. Wouldn't have wanted him there. I love the chance for 45. Like, yeah, vote him out. Anyway, backwards to school. You know, I'll be on that until, and just hope that those who are in place to make the experience of learning better than it's been in recent months. Not totally negative, but a report that you probably got on your cards, report cards, when they gave out report cards and it used to say needs improvement. I'll just leave it there. I had planned to play Robert Reich's 10 Steps to Impeachment and also Barrington Levy, Demo Murderer, and you know what that responds to. I'll be dedicating a song to Breonna Taylor at the close of the show, but I really am thankful for you, Max. I should say this now in case time runs out and you have to play that extended version of an appeal, which tells you what we really need. I just want to really thank the guests who've been on already, Reverend Dr. Khadija Mateen, Solio, and Anthony Olubumi Akinbola, and thank myself. So, Max, I trust you're dialing up our next guest, and I can keep chatting, but I'm sure she's ready to come on, and I'll keep talking until you let me know that she is absolutely ready for me. While I'm waiting, I can tell you one more time that you should really check out the creative exhibition that Solio has curated at Nordstrom on West 57th Street. So do check it out. So stand by. I think there's more to come. We have a few more minutes to be with you. And I will shortly welcome Gia Watson.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Good evening.
Good morning, or hello, good evening.
Where are you in the world? It is morning somewhere in the world, and you being a child of spirit and earth, it could be that time where you happen to be speaking to me from.
So, I'm actually in Brooklyn.
Hey. Miss Brooklyn, I haven't been able to get there in the studio, but I hear there's some whispers of it potentially opening up soon. So you're my closer for this evening, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the toxicity in the environment, but it's not just in the environment. It's coming out of the mouths of some of these people who have aspirations to continue running this world into the ground. So let's begin. You know, it's affecting how we breathe even. It's affecting how we breathe even, you know, because you have to sort of take, deep breaths, you know, like you're a yoga teacher or you're a student of yoga?
Both. I'm always a student, but I am teaching.
Wonderful. Well, I'll be looking forward to coming to one of your classes. So I haven't heard much in the way of how the indigenous population will be voting, or are they even counted? Let's start there.
Well, I mean, everybody's counted as you vote. Native American population only makes up about 3% of the total population. And we do vote. All sovereign nations even have their own constitution, so we vote within our own tribal elections, which happen around the same time as the November elections, and for the most part. But we do vote. And
yeah, I wasn't implying that wasn't a process in which the community entered into by any means, but just wondering, like we're almost being told, everybody's almost being told, like however you do it, even though those very same people who are saying that are mailing in their votes as well. I'm being a little cheeky now, but let me stop and let you do what I always ask you to. Just give us perspective on how all that's going on is impacting. We're hearing a little more about COVID-19 affecting certain communities, but there's just so much more, you know, because even as the days sort of dwindle down to the remaining ones after which folks make the choice that they make, it's just like, can I say effing crazy?
Yeah.
But I'm going to try to be decent. So just share how you're feeling. I hope well, you know, and I hope that your ability to step lively isn't impacted in a negative way too much longer. And you know what I'm talking about. But go ahead.
I mean, just starting off, let's talk about funding for Native American, a lot of the Native American facilities have been cut back. So Native Americans have health care. That was part of the deal with the United States government. We have health care. If you are an enrolled federally recognized Native person of the United States, you are covered under the Indian Health Service in the United States for your health coverage. And a lot of that Indian Health Service prior to the Trump administration was as good as like most county hospitals, so it wasn't the best. And since the Trump administration, he's even cut funding even further for a lot of those health facilities in different Native American communities. So that was already, you know, when he was elected 4 years ago, that was an issue. And it's only become more of a problem as we continue with this same administration. And then that just trickles down the line. So a lot of cultural programs for Native American people. So there's programs that were in place for a long time with the State Department where Native American groups would do cross-cultural education programs with other indigenous nations around the world. So Native American groups would fly under the State Department into, say, somewhere like Venezuela. And the embassies in Venezuela would connect with the indigenous communities in Venezuela and bring in Native communities from the United States and do cross-cultural education and ambassadorship. And those programs have been since cut as well, since Trump has come into play. A lot of the funding and a lot of the cultural enrichment that happens around Native culture has been eliminated. So, and that's been a while. And that was foreseen. So coming out of the Obama administration and into the Trump, when it was apparent that that could be a possibility, it was like a brace. And then, sure enough, Trump comes into office, and those fundings went away. I used to be a part of, well, I am a part of two traveling cultural troops, and I have not done any cross-cultural education programs with the United States in State Departments since the Trump administration began. And, you know,
when you mention education, I would, you know, with things being a little discombobulated, may I say, with the back to school here in New York and other states and across the country, and opening and closing, and the numbers rising and falling, but still not feeling really safe, you know, for many parents. So I wondered, since the schooling sometimes has been under the influence of, you know, whatever is being learned in the area surrounding the communities where Native Americans live, and if they are eligible for any of the, how should I say, the technology that would help them in some form or fashion, if you're familiar with that.
So for my
when I said technology, I mean, you know, receiving laptops and iPads and the like. Yes,
I only know from my tribe, because my sister-in-law works for the tribal communications company, which the tribe owns our communication company on the reservation. They've opened up hotspots in different places on the res, so kids can come into those places and get free Wi-Fi if they don't have internet at their homes. They've also bought laptops so that children can use for their distance learning. And that has been funded in part by some of the money that the tribe gets from federal funding, but it also comes from our own internal funding, like the money that we get from our resources. We have a casino in our tribe, so and it's different from tribe to tribe. Some that are more I guess they benefit from being close to proximity to cities. For instance, in Arizona, there are two very well-to-do tribes in the Arizona Phoenix metropolitan area. They do very well because they're situated just outside of where rich white communities are. So they have casinos just right outside, and all the money that comes from these rich white communities gets funneled into their businesses, and therefore they're able to flourish within their own community. But that's just for their communities. It's harder for other communities that are more distant outside of metropolitan cities. So, and for those people, it becomes even more of a struggle to have those resources. I think that rural America in general is struggling with having Wi-Fi in their house for distance learning, right? I've seen multiple articles where you see families of low income, and they're having to sit outside and kind of borrow Wi-Fi from a building or a school, and you've got their kids sitting for 8 hours at a time out on lawns just to kind of do their schoolwork. That's a problem in rural America nationwide. It's even more of a problem in a lot of the rural, distant areas of Native nations across the United States.
One last question.
Sure.
As we about to wrap up, the time just clicks by, I guess, with my add-ons as well. The fires, are they close to any of the concentrated areas where indigenous people are? The fires that are...
In California?
Yes.
Yes and no. So... A lot of the there's a lot of California nations, and I can't really speak to exactly. I know that there are a lot of California nations that are in Southern California, those lands that are out in the northern sort of part of Los Angeles, where they're kind of really spreading across. It's affecting everybody. is not just Native people. So, and those communities are really, really small. So the amount of land that California Natives have isn't that huge of a chunk to be a headline for a lot of people to know that, like, these lands are Native lands. Because right. to say very bluntly, like, a lot of the Native nations in California kind of got screwed on their land anyway, of course, because it's California. It's like New York, right? Like, New York, we're sitting on this, like, gold mine of land, and the Native people here in New York don't have, you know, they're not on their ancestral lands here. They've been kind of pushed out on the outside. We don't even see them. California is the same way. So you've got really small chunks of land of Natives that are there. So I can't really tell you exactly, like, what right. the amount of land is.
Well, I have to have you back because I have to wrap up, and I want to know more about that because the impact, of course, it reflects and impacts lots of communities. But I'm really interested and always especially grateful when you come on because we get to talk about some things that are, you know, not in the headlines. I want to thank you so much, Gia Watson. We're going to close out with the artist that I'm told is one of Breonna Taylor's favorites, and that's Mary J. Blige. Malika Lee Whitney, Untitled, WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM. Thank you so much to all my guests. Thank you, Gia. And thank you, Max Schmid. Reminisce.
Tune in Saturday at 7 when Audio Stages presents Saint Heaven by Martin Casella and Keith Gordon. It's 1957, and the poor black population of the backwater mining town of Saint Heaven is mourning the loss of their only doctor, a white man. When the doctor's son returns to bury his father, clean up his affairs, and quickly return to Detroit, the strong pressure to stay, to follow in his beloved father's footsteps, and the growing affection for a young girl who speaks in tongues creates dramatic conflicts. You'll enjoy St. Heaven's contemporary gospel R&B score and the intimate and heartbreaking love story. Tune in Saturday at 7.
Tune in to WBAI this Saturday at 8 p.m. for the Metropolitan Virtual Playhouse as we present Pendleton King's one-act, Cocaine. Nora and Joe are hopelessly in love but have hit bottom. A failing prostitute and a washed-up prize fighter are out of money, food, and the stuff to which they are addicted. When the landlady offers Joe a temporary way out, Nora has another, more permanent proposal. The Obie Award-winning Metropolitan Playhouse has been finding America one play at a time since 1993. Please tune in Saturday at 8 p.m. on 99.5 WBAI or streaming at WBAI.org.
And that is where you were tuned, WBAI New York.